On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday morning, and it's Maryland morning. We'll start with a conversation with Steve Phillips, the co-founder of PowerPack.org, which has worked to mobilize voters in underrepresented communities. In his new book, Brown is the New White, he argues that people of color and progressive whites constitute a new American majority, and that acting with an understanding of this new reality is the key to the future success of the Democratic Party. Then the Academy Awards are on Sunday night. Our fashion guru, Zoe Washington Chef, takes a tour of the Walters Art Museum. You know all that jewelry you'll see on the red carpet? It's so 19th century. One thing you won't see on the red carpet is any African-Americans who've been nominated for their work as actors. April Rain is the creator of the hashtag OscarsSoWhite. We'll talk about Hollywood's diversity problem, and Gil Sandler joins us with this week's Baltimore story. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Before we get going this morning, I want to congratulate Dr. Carla Hayden, the director of the Pratt Library. On Tuesday, President Obama announced that he would nominate Dr. Hayden to be the 14th Librarian of Congress. She would be the first woman and the first African-American to hold that position. Of course, it requires congressional approval, and that confirmation process has not yet begun, but we send our best wishes to Dr. Hayden and kudos to President Obama for nominating such a qualified and wonderful person. She's a great friend of this show, of course, and a terrific friend to the city of Baltimore. Now, it's my pleasure to welcome Steve Phillips to the program. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the co-founder of a social justice organization called PowerPack, which has mobilized voters in support of political candidates like Barack Obama, Cory Booker, and Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris. With Super Tuesday just around the corner and the political season in full swing, there is much talk these days about how candidates of both major parties are appealing to the various constituencies in their parties, from the Tea Party and evangelicals on the right to the progressives and people of color on the left. Steve Phillips has written a very persuasive book in which he explains how the demography of the United States has changed so dramatically over the last 50 years that never before has the progressive movement in America had as good a chance of dominating the political landscape as it has now. The book is called Brown is the New White: How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. Steve Phillips joins me on the line from his home in San Francisco. Good morning, Mr. Phillips. Thanks for getting up early for us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
So your basic thesis is that if, in terms of the electorate, if we combine people of color with white progressives, that is enough to create a very powerful political bloc. Explain the math. How's that work?
Right. So what has happened is that the composition of the country has changed so much since the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement and the Immigration and Nationality Act in particular, that people of color have grown from 12% of the population to 38%. And so that comprises the cornerstones of what I'm calling the new American majority in alliance with the meaningful minority of progressive whites. There's always section of whites who vote Democratic and who have sided with people of color over the years. And so looking at exit polls, that's about 40% of whites. So if you take 40% of whites, or should I say 39%, because that was Obama's re-election number, and 81% of people of color, and look at that in terms of the entire eligible voter pool of the country, that's 51% of all the people within the country. And my thesis is that that is what elected Obama and, most importantly, reelected him when he lost 5 million white votes but still got reelected.
And, of course, the ramifications of this include the fact that you talk about the preoccupation that Democrats have had in chasing the so-called white swing voter. You talk about how people are sort of fixated on this magical number of 2044, the year in which the United States will become a so-called majority-minority country. Why is it, in your estimation, so inadvisable for Democrats to be so preoccupied with these white swing voters now?
Because I talk in the book about what I call the tyranny of the white swing voter. And so historically, politics in this country has been a competition between progressive whites and conservative whites for the white swing in the middle. And in order to win over those votes, historically the approach has been to moderate one's politics, to mute one's call for social justice. And that goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson drafting the Declaration of Independence and taking out the references to slavery, to Abraham Lincoln in the debates in 1859 saying he supported ending slavery but not equality between the races, and all the way up to 2014 when the Democrats ran away from immigration reform, ran away from health care, ran away from their black president in the Senate. And it results in its downward spiral because it's ineffective in winning over the whites in the middle, and it also results in a diminished level of enthusiasm on the part of the voters of color who are necessary to comprise the majority to win.
The book is called Brown is the New White. My guest is the author Steve Phillips on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So in your title, Brown is the New White, you're basically asserting that whites can no longer be the starting point. We've got to be the Democratic Party in particular has to be taking much more seriously the political power and capacity of minorities and white progressives. That's going to require a big epiphany, isn't it, on the part of the leadership of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party?
Yes, it does. But you would think that people would have grasped that from the Obama election, the Obama numbers. But the fact that they don't is really what compelled me to try to write the book, to try to send a real wake-up call and inject a sense of urgency into the political population. The incontrovertible evidence of the past 8 years is that when we've had large and enthusiastic turnout of voters of color and progressive whites, that has resulted in victories, 2008 and 2012. When people have not been mobilized, not been inspired to turn out, we've lost and lost badly. In 2010 and 2014, that's how the House was lost and that's how the Senate was lost. So if you look at the numbers, it's actually fairly clear. But for whatever reason, too many people who run Democratic politics remain obsessed with this population that is shrinking, elusive, and we have been ineffective at reaching.
One of the fiscal ramifications of this, or the money ramifications of this, you talk about the election of Kay Hagan, that she ran when she lost her North Carolina Senate seat. She spent $19 million on attack ads against her Republican opponent, who eventually won that race. And you make a very interesting argument about how that money could have been spent and how that might have affected the outcome.
Right. And so that's one of the clearest examples. This is actually the outside groups in that race. So, again, it's a question of, I'm talking about Chapter 6, talks about invest wisely, and how do you actually look at your spending your money to get the 50% plus one. So you can either try to persuade the so-called likely voters, which is more white than the overall population, and that was the point of these $19 million in attack ads, it was to try to change the minds of those white swing voters, or you can invest your money in trying to inspire and mobilize and turn out your own base. And if the progressive forces had hired, they could have hired 400 full-time staff people going door-to-door, making phone calls, turning out friends and neighbors over the course of an entire year. If each of those people had just gotten three additional votes per week, with 2 weeks off for vacation, Hagan would have won the election.
You commissioned a report called the Fannie Lou Hamer Report, in which you audited Democratic spending in 2010 and 2014. The spending on campaigns was more than $500 million, but it all went to a very somewhat rarefied constituency, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. So it's this is the thing we think was the first audit ever done of Democratic Party spending. And so over $500 million spent by the various party committees, 97% of the money went to white consultants. And so in a party where the voters are 46% people of color, and so there's a profound disconnect in terms of who is making the ads, who is doing the outreach, who's running the campaigns, and who comprises the voters that are necessary to victory.
And that really is sort of at the crux of this as well, is just that the folks who are running the show when it comes to running these political campaigns, their perspective isn't one of people of color and people who've been generally marginalized. I mean, later in the program, we're going to talk about the Academy Awards and the woman who created the hashtag Oscars So White. It seems like there's an awful lot of parallels here when it comes to the Democratic Party and the members of the Academy.
Yeah, well, very much so, man. That Hollywood was one of the best examples of the persistence of, really, frankly, the preference for white people in terms of hiring. That 95% of the lead actors in Hollywood and shows are white in a society that's 62% white. I mean, that does not occur by accident. That does not occur without a fairly active, although probably, you know, unconscious or semi-conscious bias in favor of hiring whites. And so, and that's what you saw, frankly, in Maryland with the Senate race. You know, two good candidates there, but the U.S. has never had has had one black woman in the U.S. Senate in the history of the United States. And so rather than let that race play out, 2 days after Mikulski retired, Harry Reid came in and endorsed the white male candidate rather than either backing the black woman candidate or at least letting them compete. And so that's another example of the failure to invest in and prioritize the new American majority.
But of course, so much of this does, when it comes to having a powerful political voice and capacity, it requires folks to show up to the polls. And you've mentioned that in 2010, 2014, it wasn't necessarily swing voters fled, but we had a very low turnout among a progressive coalition that included people of color. What's it going to take to get folks out to the polls to vote?
Well, it requires both a combination of a policy agenda, which speaks to people's interest and inspires them, as well as a massive investment of resources in terms of hiring from the communities, hiring consultants who know how to reach the communities, and being able to engage and pull out their friends and neighbors to get them to the polls. People don't realize that Obama had 200,000 more black votes in Ohio in 2012 than he did in 2010. And the way he did that was he had 600 full-time staff people working for more than a year, partnering with churches, going door to door, identifying people in their neighborhoods. It's that kind of work that's necessary and effective in terms of getting people out to vote.
Steve Phillips, his book is a really interesting read. Check it out. It's called Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Mr. Phillips, thanks for your time and thanks for the book. I really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Coming up later in the program, I'll speak with the creator, as I mentioned, the creator of the hashtag Oscars So White. And after a break for the news, we'll check in with our fashion guru, Zoe Washington Chef. She's been to, of all places, the Walters Art Museum in search of the origins of bling. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Walters Art Museum is known around the world for a wide-ranging collection that ranges from the antiquity to the early 20th century. The museum was established by the 19th century tycoon William Walters and later run by his son Henry to house their personal collection of European art. Zoe Washington Chef is our resident fashion guru. Zoe's a stylist, a fashion editor, and the CEO of the fashion consulting company Little Bird. Last week, Zoe and producer Jonna McCone went to the Walters to explore its collection of jewelry and how the ornate Victorian styles of the past are referenced in today's style and on the red carpet. So, Zoe, first of all, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And so what drew you to the Walters?
Well, the Walters has such an impressive collection of statement jewelry from the likes of Rene Lalique and Louis Comfort Tiffany. So it was a natural transition.
So you and our producer, John McCone, went down there. Who'd you talk to?
We went down there. We spoke to Joe Briggs, who's the associate curator of 18th and 19th century art at the Walters. She's amazing.
Great. Let's take a listen.
We're here in the Grand Salon, is that correct?
This is the World's Fair Room. We're right off the Grand Salon.
Right off the Grand Salon. I love this room, by the way, because it's so dramatic and ornate, and I just want to put on a ball gown and move in. basically.
Thank you for saying that. We had a lot of fun installing it and choosing the colors.
And we're here looking at your amazing collection of Tiffany and Lalique pieces. A lot of people don't really know who René Lalique is. Do you mind speaking to who he is as a designer?
He was an incredibly innovative guy, and he is a really important part of the Art Nouveau artistic style, the trend for which kind of swept the world around 1900. He is probably best known for his later, more mass-produced glassware, so like perfume bottles, car hood ornaments, and vases. But prior to launching that very successful business in glass, he actually got his start in his career with very high-end bespoke jewelry. And this is really in the period from about 1890 through to about 1910, so what's known as the Belle Epoque in Paris, the beautiful era. And he, in this moment, he's really associating himself with some very famous women who he learns a lot from. They're his muses. And then he subsequently trades that fame into this very successful glass business, which is really for a much wider audience. You didn't have to be Sarah Bernhardt or a famous actress to buy the perfume bottles, but you certainly had to be a very special woman to commission and wear some of these high-end jewelry pieces that he was making at that time.
Which is interesting, because I think that business model really translates today to a lot of modern jewelry houses. But first things first, let's talk about how you guys acquired these amazing pieces.
That's a great question. What are these things doing in Baltimore? What are these icons of Art Nouveau in Paris doing here? Well, it's really a story about our founder, and that is a man called Henry Walters. He was born in 1848, and when he died in 1931, he left his amazing art collection to the city of Baltimore. He traveled around a lot, and that's really the key to how these pieces ended up here. So he was in Paris in 1900 for the World's Fair, and these events happened very regularly in the 19th century, and they showcased art and industry from across the world, and Henry attended them religiously, as his father did. And so in 1900 in Paris, he sees the incredibly innovative display by René Lalique, and it was beautiful. It had dragonfly women with gauzy wings, and Lalique hung all of his jewelry off of these wings, and it got a lot of great press at the time. Unfortunately, most of the pieces were already sold. So when Lalique shows for the first time in America in a big way, it's actually another World's Fair, St. Louis, 1904, and Henry, because he knows Lalique is so good, he gets right to the front of the line, and he ends up buying 9 pieces, which are now in the Walters Art Museum, and most of them are on display in this fourth floor gallery.
Is it typical for a man like Henry Walters to buy up 9 or 10 pieces of Lalique jewelry for the sake of collecting, or would they perhaps been designed to wear? Was there someone in his life that he might want to have given this to, or was it only for the collection?
Well, in this case, it's only for the collection. Henry did marry, but very late in life and well after he bought this jewelry. He was likely modeling his buying habits on that of another very wealthy man who made his money in the oil industry, and that's Colust Gulbenkian. And Gulbenkian actually founded a museum in Lisbon. And he actually bought 150 pieces from Lalique, commissioned and bought them. And so that was really, I think, although we have no documentary evidence to prove it, I think Henry was looking at Gulbenkian as a model for a museum, someone who was building a museum who was buying from Lalique. And so Henry wanted to put his collection on a par with that of Gulbenkian, and hence these 9 pieces ended up here. They went straight from the World's Fair to the museum. Visitors are always asking me, were other pieces like this one? Right. And the answer is that yes, they were, but it did take a very special kind of woman to do that.
So does Lalique have a sort of harem of women that are his muses or his patrons? And what was that relationship like with the women who he serviced?
He was a very smart businessman. He certainly did very well out of these relationships with extremely high-profile women. But what I also want to emphasize is that it's really a symbiotic relationship. These women aren't just clothes sources or models for Lalique. He's actually taking something from them and using it in his innovative jewelry. So just to give an example of that, he works very closely with Sarah Bernhardt, who's probably the most famous actress in the 19th century, internationally famous, touring in Europe and America. And she collaborated with Velik at least twice, and perhaps more often. It's always hard to know with Sarah Bernhardt exactly who came up with the idea, because she was very hands-on, and she controlled her image very carefully. So when she was acting on the stage, she collaborated in designing the sets, the costumes, and also the very large theatrical jewelry that she wore on stage. He made a very large blue lotus that she wore in the role of Isley, and he also made a very, very large pearl lily tiara that she wore in her role as the faraway princess. So if you look at our very beautiful orchid comb, you see how huge it is. It's probably, what, about 26 centimeters high, maybe about 20 centimeters across, so about 8 inches. And it's huge. It's a statement piece for sure. And I think he was learning about the importance of scale.
You know, you mentioned multiple times the idea of Art Nouveau and how dramatic these pieces are. Can you just explain a little bit for our listeners exactly what constitutes an Art Nouveau jewelry piece?
Art Nouveau, obviously in French, it simply means new art. It actually is taken from the name of a store, and that was La Maison de l'Art Nouveau, so the house of the new art.
Where Lalique was sold.
Yes. And Lalique sold at the store, and this opened in 1895. The style is really characterized by curving lines. So they were often looking for inspiration to nature, to the female form, to hair, to smoke. And they're incorporating these into jewelry, into architecture, into furniture design. It's really a style that crosses all the different art forms at this moment.
Historically, at this time period, around the late 19th century, why would you say that people are now relying on influences from nature and these sort of curvilinear forms?
It's a complicated situation, but it's somewhat a reaction to industrialization and mass production. So Lalique actually spent some time in England, and the famous kind of exponent of the arts and crafts style is William Morris. And so I think what happens is Lalique is picking up on some of these arts and crafts ideas. And the arts and crafts movement really reacted against, you know, big factory production that really dehumanized the workers and wanted to turn back to a much more creative work environment for people in general. Having said that, one of the things that Lalique was criticized for was that his work was so high-end, it couldn't possibly reach everybody. And one of the aims of the arts and crafts movement is that it would impact the way that people were living their everyday lives. So particular simple kinds of furniture, very beautifully designed cutlery, for example. But Lalique was obviously aiming at the wealthy. And this was actually something people picked up on and criticized him for at the time.
Would you also say that this kind of coincides with the establishing of the first real mega brands? Now you see, you know, everybody knows Tiffany, Bulgari, Cartier, and I feel like Lalique seems like someone who was becoming a brand more so than just a designer.
Lalique really does become a brand, but he's using this formative moment where he's making these high-end one-off pieces for a particularly famous set of women to springboard into that mass production. And it's a little bit like, I always think about, you know, the Oscar red carpet. Mm-hmm. You see somebody wearing, say, Dolce & Gabbana. There's no way that I, as a museum curator, could afford to buy a Dolce & Gabbana dress, but I might be able to afford the perfume or the sunglasses. There's a very similar thing happening with Lalique. And it's certainly the 19th century, when people are moving to the cities, literacy is increasing, print technology is increasing, photography allows you to actually see people wearing this jewelry and clothes for the first time. It's a time when people are maybe able to afford a few luxuries. And so it's a really important moment for, as you're saying, the sort of the start of that brand culture. Leek was super, super smart in getting his messaging across and creating a lot of longevity for his firm.
This is the time where you see, for the first time, someone really using the star power of his associations, his amazing designs, knowing that they're unconventional, playing into that, and building a brand off of it, and almost creating diffusion lines with the glassware, which have equal amounts of creativity and craftsmanship, but taking it to a more mass market level.
And I think what's really interesting about this period is maybe prior to this, it had mostly been aristocratic women, so say Queen Victoria, that was setting style. But at this moment, it's shifting more towards actresses, even courtesans. So high-end prostitutes were setting the fashion in Paris, and they were being written up in the newspapers. And so they were getting a lot more exposure than previously.
So when you were speaking about René Lalique's relationship with his muses, I'll say, you spoke about size and sort of impact. Would you say that this is the heyday for statement jewelry?
I think about this in the sense of fashion cycles. There's always moments in history where huge pieces of jewelry are in vogue, and then it kind of swings back the other way, and very delicate small pieces become fashionable. But certainly, I think, in terms of the innovative combination of materials that's going on at this time, it's really a very high point for jewelry innovation in general.
As I look around at these amazing pieces, they call to mind a lot of contemporary designers and their influence, whether it's from nature or even just the techniques and the unconventional combination of materials that are used. When people typically think of statement jewelry, I was saying earlier, they think of gigantic gems and almost like the queen's jewelry, whereas here it's a lot more subtle, even though it's hugely impactful. When I look at this tiger necklace, for example, to me, immediately when I see it, it reminds me of several contemporary designers now, like Lulu Frost, Oscar de la Renta, where you see these really great pieces of horn and enamel and motifs from nature in a very wearable silhouette. So this round collar that would sit very close to the neck, and it would almost become an addition to whatever clothing you were wearing and would become that statement piece. This looks just like something I saw at J. Crew, for example.
For sure. I mean, Lalique's influence really has a very, very long moment. This kind of way of combining, so in this piece, for example, the necklace that we're talking about here, the tiger necklace, it's from about 1903. It combines gold, which, you know, that's pretty typical for jewelry, but it also has enamel and horn, so an organic material, as well as tortoise shell and agate. And it's a pretty fierce piece. So it has all these tigers that are kind of going in a procession all around it, but it's interspersed with these pointed pieces of horn. It's something that feels very contemporary. I could totally imagine walking into a high-end jewelry store and seeing this for sale today. And so it's kind of amazing that, you know, it's over 110 years old.
Exactly.
And it just shows how cutting-edge Lalique was, that it formally it still has a real resonance for us and speaks to us.
Joe Briggs is the Associate Curator of 18th and 19th Century Art at the Walters Art Museum. Our fashion guru, Zoe Washington Sheff, and producer, Jonna McCone, spoke with her earlier this month. So, Zoe, that was really fun to hear. Now that you're back from the museum, I wonder if the patrons of the art of the turn of the century, are they like parallel to today's celebrities?
They are. It's really amazing because when you look at the Oscars or the Golden Globes, you always see these celebrities walking the red carpet with these gigantic Cartier necklaces or Bulgari necklaces. But on a more intimate level, they have relationships with these jewelry houses where they really influence the design themselves and it reflects their own sense of personal style. So they're both building a brand in a way.
Mm-hmm. And just like the old days. I mean, they were people
just
building
like
brands.
Just like the old days, building the brands. And really, René Lalique is a great example of that. He really used his star power and the star power of his glam squad to build his brand.
So now, do you think that we'll be seeing more stuff about fashion and lifestyle exhibits at museums like the Walters? I mean, there's this great, you know, austere house of, you know, antique art and all that stuff.
Oh, I do. I think people are really interested in it. I think it adds another layer to what you typically see in editorial, online. Creating that sense of gravitas behind fashion and art is really important, and it really puts it in a special context so people understand why they're wearing what they're wearing.
Because I guess it's almost kind of amazing to think that some of the stuff that's at the Walters, women actually wore.
Women actually
wore. This was day-to-day jewelry.
Exactly. And when you see people today, people invest in
jewelry like that today. So it's really great to have that sense of continuity.
All right. Zoe Washington Sheff, she's a stylist, a fashion editor, and the CEO of the fashion consulting company Little Bird. She's a regular contributor here on Marilyn Morning. The exhibit at the Walters, it's called From Rye to Raphael, and it features the jewelry of Tiffany and Lalique. It's there until the end of March. We've got info at wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. Thanks, Zoe. We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Lots more coming up.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wipr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome back on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. It's Marilyn Morning. Last year, April Rain, who lives in Howard County, created the Twitter hashtag OscarsSoWhite when the 2015 Oscars didn't include any nominations for people of color in the acting categories. Many folks, for example, thought that the film Selma, directed by Ava DuVernay and its lead actor, David Oyelowo, should have received nominations. And of course, as you've no doubt heard, this year's nominations were no different. This has sparked even more activity around the Oscars So White hashtag, and it has intensified the national conversation about the clear and troubling lack of diversity in Hollywood. April Rain is a former attorney and the managing editor of BroadwayBlack.com. She joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a huge thing. This has sparked an enormous conversation, and you were way out ahead of this. I mean, there are a few celebrities who are boycotting the Oscars Sunday night, but you started this a year ago. Trace the arc for us from when you put it out and then what's happened since then and now with this year's awards coming up.
Sure. I created the hashtag in January of 2015 in my family room as I was watching the nominations announced on live TV, and I was frustrated and disappointed with the lack of marginalized communities that had been nominated, not just in the acting categories, but also with respect to filmmakers who work behind the camera. So I started the very first tweet on that day and just vented my frustration on Twitter. We saw some support at that time. Unfortunately, here we are in 2016, and not only is the hashtag still relevant, but it's also experienced a resurgence. And so now Academy President Cheryl Boone Isaacs has announced several decisions that were unanimous by the Board of Governors to not only increase the diversity amongst the Academy itself, but also to change its voting system.
And what do you think of those suggestions and those new plans?
I think they're a good start. I still have some concerns. I believe that all awards should be based on merit. But what we know is that Academy members are not required to view the films or the performances before they vote. And therefore, how can you say that the Academy Awards, the actual awards, are based on merit when they haven't seen the films? So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done, and the onus remains on Hollywood to create quality performances and quality films that the Academy can actually nominate.
It's been noted that the people who vote on the Oscars are mostly over the age of 50. 94% of them are white, 77% of them are male. Do you think that's the issue, that perhaps even if they did see the films, I mean, if that particular electorate had seen Straight Outta Compton, the theory goes that, you know, they just had no way of relating to it, therefore they wouldn't have supported it.
Well, I think that's one problem, but we also have seen Academy members speaking anonymously, of course, who said that they just would not go see particular movies. And it's unfortunate because I think we can all be better people when we broaden our perspectives and maybe step outside of our comfort zone. I think the Academy took this in mind when they invited over 300 new members, more diverse members into the Academy, and indicated this year that they will be expanding the number and hopefully doubling the number of diverse Academy members by 2020.
Because you've been very careful to point out, ever since you did this a year ago, that this is not about a particular snub of a particular movie or a particular actor, that this is a much larger issue.
Absolutely. And this is not just a race issue. It is also an issue with respect to sexual orientation. Those from the LGBTQ community, other ethnicities other than just black people, the indigenous community, the differently abled, it's all marginalized communities who should be better represented in film.
Last year, you boycotted the Oscars and organized some people to watch an Eddie Murphy movie, Coming to America, a really funny movie. It was noted that the ratings for the Oscars last year were the worst that they've been in a long time. Are you going to boycott again this year on Sunday night?
I'm not using the word boycott because I think that's a flashpoint that the media uses because it's easy and simplistic. What I'm saying is that we are inviting everyone who is disappointed with the lack of representation of marginalized communities in film to join us on Twitter Sunday night as we live tweet a coming of age movie called The Wood. But there are a lot of counter programming events going on. And even if you're not interested in watching that particular film, just use the OscarSoWhite hashtag and let us know what you're doing other than watching the telecast.
And what about the celebrities who have decided to stay away from the ceremony? Do you think that's an effective strategy and effective, and you know, it's going to be, is that going to work?
Well, I'm not sure because I haven't spoken to them, so I don't know what their goals are. I do know that there is going to be a Justice for Flint event that night as well on Sunday night, which is very important and shines a light on the horrible problems that so many people are having with their drinking water. And there will be a lot of celebrities and public figures attending that event in Michigan. And there are also other counter programming events planned, but everyone has to make a choice for this for themselves. So, for example, Mark Ruffalo, who is an Oscar-nominated actor this year, does plan to attend, but has spoken out very strongly about the lack of diversity.
Chris Rock is going to be the host. There are folks who've called for his removing himself from that position he's hosted before. What are your thoughts about his status in this?
I think Chris Rock is a brilliant comedian, and he is very well known for his social and political commentary. And so I expect him to kill it Sunday night. You know, it has been reported that he has changed his monologue so that he can directly address the OscarSoWhite issue. But I think he knew what he was getting into when he signed on to do it this year. And I also think that the Academy knew. You know, they are involved in a little bit of self-reflection and introspection. And so I think they're expecting him to fully bring it on Sunday.
Has there been much of a backlash against OscarSoWhite? I mean, there have been some celebrities, some African-American celebrities who, you know, pointedly not signed on. Jamie Foxx made comments at the Black Film Festival Awards last week and others. But what's your take on how this is being perceived generally?
Well, I think Jamie Foxx may have been joking when he made that statement. And he sits at a point of privilege, right, because he does have an Academy Award. And so his fight may be a little different than those who are still attempting to be recognized and feted by the Academy. At the same time, I think that every public figure, regardless of race, or sexual orientation or gender, should be speaking out because it only helps us all if there are more inclusive films that are made.
April Rain, she is the managing editor of BroadwayBlack.com and the creator of the hashtag OscarsSoWhite. We've got a link to more information on our website, WYPR.org/MarilynMorning. The Oscars will be broadcast on ABC TV Sunday night, and OscarsSoWhite Twitter followers will be hitting Netflix to watch The Wood. Ms. Rain, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Stars of Tri-Cat Field, you are. Stars of Tri-Cat.
That's it for us today. Coming up Monday on the day before Super Tuesday, my guest will be the Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, who's written a chronicle of the conservative movement called Why the Right Went Wrong. In a way, it's a bookend to the book by Steve Phillips that we talked about earlier this morning. I hope you can join us for that conversation, as well as a preview of a new film by local filmmakers, two white guys, Alan Moore and Leo Horrigan. That's all coming up Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is directed and engineered by Nathan Sterner. Rob Sivak, John McCone, and Kathleen Cahill are our producers. Lauren Ferguson and Brooke Savage are our interns. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville is our Java source. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded our theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Stars of track and field you are. Stars of track and